We are destined to become both prophets and beneficiaries of our own superconscious wisdom. Let's let this quote from today's guest sink in. Leonard Perlmutter, also known as Ram Lev, shares the teachings from his book, Your Conscience, The Key to Unlock Limitless Wisdom and Creativity and Solve All of Life's Challenges. I'm in. This is Robin with Tributaries. Leonard, in your book, Your Conscience, you immediately address a crisis in education, and I think we all could glean something from your perspective here.
Well, it's true. There is a crisis in education, and it centers around the fact that, and this is my experience, no matter what form of education I engaged in, the only thing that we were really taught was how to memorize other people's suggestions or findings. And that can be helpful for us, there's no question about that, because if we can memorize and then are tested on that knowledge, sooner or later we'll get a degree that will probably enable us to get a higher paying job. The problem is that nobody has taught us, number one, about the mind, and number two, how the mind works and how we can optimize the mind to access greater wisdom to solve problems and situations that we have. So that's the main issue that I have with our educational system. Our greatest asset, which is our conscience, is never even mentioned.
Right. Well,
we can laugh about it, but it's the kind of laughter that has a tear rolling down our cheek.
Very definitely, yes.
Because we're suffering, and we're suffering today because we don't have solutions to issues. There's so much conflict outside because there's so much conflict inside.
Absolutely, yes. Now, I've been very curious always about how things get divided. And here in this book, you write about the four functions of mind. Is that from ancient yogic writings, or is that a way you formulated to speak about developing our ultimate awareness?
No, I did not develop it, but I have been gifted to have had my spiritual journey connect with a teacher who taught from the oldest continuous spiritual and meditation tradition in the world. And so that is the tradition from which I speak. And that is how I came upon this knowledge, this wisdom, this tradition, this lineage is over 6,000 years old. It's older than recorded history. It is the origin of every single spiritual and religious tradition on the planet. Itself, it is not a religion. It's simply an educational body of knowledge that was received by women and men just like you and me who, through the meditation process, began to see certain eternal truths. Now, we all know, as even as children, there's a sense, an intuitive sense, that it seems that I have different voices in my mind.
Right.
And those kids, you and me included, we were all correct. There are different voices in the mind. And that's really important to understand because the mind is our most powerful instrument. The mind moves first, and the body follows. What that means is, the truth is, I cannot raise my hand without first entertaining a thought. The body is not going to move. The body is not going to speak without first entertaining a thought. So our thoughts are our most powerful resource. And so there are different functions. There are four functions in the mind that talk to us. three of the functions are advisors. They're loud, they're pushy, they're insistent, they're not always wrong, but they're often wrong.
Hmm.
The fourth function of the mind is the decision maker, and that would be the conscience. The first three are the ego, the senses, and the unconscious mind. And because there's such anarchy in the mind, truly, the ego, senses, and unconscious mind, they're lobbyists. They cannot make the choice, and they are reacting to the fear of annihilation coming from the reptilian brain. You know, I don't want to die. I don't want to die. I don't want the form to be no more. And because of that, the ego, the senses, and the unconscious mind emphasize that which appears as being pleasant.
A big word there, isn't it? Appears.
Yes, appears. It's the appearance. It's not the reality.
Right, yes.
But it's the appearance of pleasure. And so all this creative energy goes from the mind through the ego, the senses, and the unconscious mind, and they're often wrong in their assessment and their recommendations, but they're never in doubt.
Yes, and you write about the unconscious mind as a repository for fear and anger and unfulfilled desires.
Yes, yes. Because all of these addictions of the ego and the senses, everything that we deem essential to self-preservation is all stored in the unconscious mind, which is sort of analogous to the hard drive of the computer. Mm-hmm. And then that which is stored on the hard drive becomes the operating system for the computer. And unless we're aware of what's going on in the mind to coordinate it and to use the conscience properly, that software package, which is fraught with many, many faults that we received from whom? From mom, from dad, from grandma, from grandpa. You know, it wasn't malicious. Mom and dad and grandma and grandpa and all our friends in school and our teachers and politicians and the culture, they were not malicious. They were trying to do the same, just trying to get along.
Exactly. And I sort of see the collective unconscious as a superhighway of these thoughts and feelings that you're just talking about right now that came from our parents and grandparents and friends, etc., all doing their best to do the best. And yet, because of our experiences, we decide which things that are floating by in this collective unconscious highway that we're going to buy into and hold. And you follow these teachings with the idea of successfully parenting the mind. And I'm wondering, how do you do that? What's key in that piece?
The key, as with everything, is love. Love and attention. I always equate attention with love.
Mm.
Whenever we love something or love somebody, what happens? Oh, automatically the energy of the mind is focused on that object, on that person. So we need to recognize that the functions of the mind, the three functions of the mind, the ego, the senses, and the unconscious mind, they have a situation that they're dealing with. It's a little bit analogous to PTSD. They've been traumatized because nobody's really in charge, and they have assumed the responsibility of self-preservation. That's a lot of responsibility. And my feeling is that the ego ultimately knows that the ego does not know. However, there's nobody else who's parenting this mind-body-sense complex. So what happens is the ego, the senses, and the unconscious mind, those three functions of the mind, which cannot make a decision, they become these overzealous lobbyists, these salespeople that are clamoring. They're insistent. they can become rather obnoxious. And all that noise in the mind, from the ego senses and unconscious mind, you know, I want, I fear, I'm angry. When all that noise cannot be dissipated, then the conscience, which is the only function of the mind that can make a choice, its ability is compromised by all the noise. Right, and the only thing that the conscience can do in that situation is to rubber stamp the loudest voice it can hear.
Yes, and yet, when you get to that point where you recognize what's going on, that noise, at a certain point, the conscious will recognize, oh, I'm in this place of noise, so therefore it's time to make that shift. It's time to go in another direction. And the more practiced one gets, the less and less you sit around with that noise, with that anger, with that PTSD or whatever it is. And so maybe you could share what your most difficult mind habit was to break free from and how you saw that transition.
Well, the most challenging issue that has been a lifelong companion has been fear. Fear in its many forms. And every fear must be examined. Because, you see, President Roosevelt, back in the 30s, was correct. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so fear always has one of two faces, one or two forms. Either I'm afraid I might not get what I want, or I'm afraid I might lose what I have. Mm-hmm. And so many decades ago, I had a colleague and a teacher, and I said to this person, gee, I have fallen in love with this philosophy and this science of yoga, but I'm self-employed. I'm an art dealer. That's how I make a living. I don't know one day to the next or one month to the next when I'm going to sell a painting and have any money coming in, but the bills keep on coming in, so I have to deal with a lot of fear. Perhaps this yoga science is better suited for people who work for the government. Oh, they get a check every week. They have health insurance, perhaps a retirement plan. And he looked at me. He says, well, your problem is you consider yourself self-employed. Mm-hmm. And yet I am employed by the self. And the light bulb went on in my mind. Oh, I understand completely. What he's saying is, the more that I let the conscience be my guide and parent the ego, senses, and unconscious mind to share their perspective, we want them to be received, we love them, we don't want to get rid of them, we don't want to criticize them. We ask each one, what is your opinion here? And then ask each one to quiet down, and in that quietude, call on the conscience. Now, in the quietude of the mind, when the lake of the mind is still, then the conscience has a unique ability. It can act like a mirror and reflect super conscious wisdom from the super conscious portion of the mind at the core of our being. And that's the same portion of the mind where Paul McCartney hears beautiful melodies and where Albert Einstein saw mathematical equations. Doesn't mean that we're going to become physicists. It doesn't mean we're going to become songwriters. What it does mean is that the more that we can love and parent the ego, the senses, and the unconscious mind to share it's their suggestions, but then to quiet down, then the conscience can reflect super conscious wisdom to tell us the thought to think, the word to speak, the action to take through this mind-body-sense complex that will enable each of us individually to fulfill the purpose of life without
And you mentioned earlier that there are only two types of thoughts. And what are they, and what is the significance of knowing that?
Well, the significance of knowing that is that it teaches us what's to be done and what's not to be done. And that's critically important. So the two types of thoughts are preya and shreya. Now, preya is some form of ego or sense gratification that conflicts with the superconscious wisdom reflected by the conscience. It's the ground upon which the personality presently stands. And there's no doubt that when we serve the preya, when we have that second jelly donut, when we worry, there's a bit of a satisfaction, sometimes with sensual gratification. There is a pleasure, but it's very short-lived, and there is always, always some form of pain in the wake of that passing pleasure. That's preya. And the other kind of thought is a shreya. Initially, not so pleasant, not so comfortable, not so attractive. But when we serve the shreya thought through thought, word, and deed, we are always led for our highest and greatest good. So if we can learn to discriminate between preya and shreya, we will know that if the thought is a shreya based on what the conscience is advising, then we serve it in mind, action, and speech, and we're led for our highest good. But if it's a preya, if we serve it, we're going to be in pain. If we repress it, we're going to become neurotic and even more pain. But if we can learn to sacrifice the preya, offering it back to the origin from which it has come, of course, everything comes from the One. Everything is manifest from the Supreme Intelligence. And so when this superconscious wisdom is saying it's not appropriate to think this thought or to speak this word or to take this action, if we can offer it back to whatever form of G-O-D we're most comfortable with and most familiar with, if we can just sacrifice it, the act of sacrifice can transform the inherent contractive, debilitating, and poisonous energy of preya, of fear, of anger, of greed. And it will be transformed, just like ice is transformed into water and water into steam. But instead of having that contractive and debilitating poisonous energy, through sacrifice, it's transformed into a healing energy, an expansion of our willpower, and an increase in our capacity to be creative.
You write about your first aid kit for worries. That fits right in with the preya here. So could you share what that entails?
Well, we all become triggered. We all get hijacked by emotional issues when we have relationships. You know, they're sort of like all these landmines that are buried in all sorts of relationships. So when we are triggered, when we worry unnecessarily, you see, what we can do is we can create a space between stimulus and response. So when the worry comes up, there's a space. I can slow things down. And in that space exists what? My freedom of action that allows me to redirect my attention from the stimulus of worry to the conscience. And I ask the conscience, is this a legitimate legitimate concern? Is it a Shreya to serve, or is it a Preya to sacrifice? So then I have my marching orders, you see. If it's a worry that is legitimate, then I take my pencil out and I turn it away from the point of the pencil and I take the eraser and I erase the equation that I just used and I rewrite the equation and I experiment again to see how I can dissolve that worry. But if the conscience then replies that it's actually, this worry is unnecessary and it's harmful, it's a Preya, I know that my action is simply to take it and sacrifice it so that that energy can be transformed.
And there's so much in that pause. It can be...
The infinite number of possibilities exist
exactly.
In the pause. And
that's not true
when we're operating with the software package.
Right.
There's very little freedom of maneuverability.
Yeah, definitely. Well said. And talk about setting aside relative truth as you do in your book.
Well, relative truth changes all the time. So if I look up at the ceiling in the room in which I'm standing right now, and somebody asks me about the height of the ceiling, oh, I would say it's high. And yet, if I were on the roof of this building, and somebody said, you know that room that you were in? How would you define that ceiling? Oh, I would say, oh, it's low.
Right.
So from the floor level, I look up at the ceiling, it's high. From the roof, it's low.
Yes, these things are not like a game, really, because it's our life. It's our lives, all of our lives that we're dealing with. But to make a conscious effort to let go of that relative truth, and it definitely falls into the good and bad. So to wake up and decide, oh, I'm going to look for relative truths that I'm speaking today. It'll be amazing how often we'll forget, but how often we will also recognize that, oh, I'm doing that again.
That's right. So at a certain point of examining what comes to us as whether it's relative or not relative, at a certain point, I, through my experimentation process, my own experimentation process, mm-hmm. as a scientist, I come to the conclusion that I have thoughts, but I am not my thoughts. I have a body, but I am not the body. Then it begs the question continuously, well, then who am I? Who am I? Who am I? Who is the thinker of this thought? And slowly, slowly, our attention goes within rather than continue this addiction of extruding our creative energy into the material world in a desperate search for happiness and security and
yes,
health.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, not that there's anything wrong with going out into the world. It can be a lovely, lovely place.
Right.
But if I am not armed with the best available wisdom, then it's like driving an automobile that only turns to the left.
That would be a drag.
It would be painful.
You know, I'm just wondering, Leonard, how successful is this book for you? And I'm not talking about the number of sales, but you share so much of your experience of consciousness and being able to write about that clearly and with huge clarity, which you do, is pretty amazing.
Well, you know, I would have to say that in 1996, my teacher, Swami Rama of the Himalayas, who I referenced earlier in our conversation, from this ancient tradition, of which now I am the latest blossom, so to speak, he sent me a letter from India And this turned out to be 3 months before he passed. And the letter had three words in it, just three words. And the three words were, start teaching now. And now, I was not raised in India. This was not familiar from birth. I never, when I was in grade school age, learned all these mantras and all this philosophy and this science, as some people did in India. I'm an American, but I was always motivated by two principles, and that is philosophy and practicality. And that led me to this teacher who really, when I first started reading his books, he sounded just like my scoutmaster when I was in Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts. Mm. And so when he sent me that note, 1996, start teaching now, what filled my mind? Fear. Oh my gosh, how could I possibly teach this? It's so humbling. And then I realized that I have to reply to this letter, first to myself. And I sat down and I contemplated, what could I possibly be teaching? What is he thinking? And what I came up with was, the only thing that I am qualified to teach is what I practice. And that then became the curriculum for my first class. And that just led me into my spiritual practice, because the more that you're a teacher, the better the student you are. If you're really a good teacher, you have to be an exquisite student. Absolutely. You always have to raise the bar in your own life. And so when I was in quarantine in March of 2020 and the American Meditation Institute was shuttered, we didn't have any students coming, I sat myself down again and I said, how am I to be of service? And I looked around through news reports and newspapers and magazines and conversations with people on the phone. And I realized how much pain people were in. Is there anything I could do that I can share with them? And what I realized was the best thing that I could do is to teach them how to access their super conscious wisdom through a working relationship with their own conscience. So you asked if this book is a success. I don't know if it's a success, but that's not a concern to me, honestly. You see, I'm sort of a modern-day Johnny Appleseed. What brings me joy and purpose is simply planting the seeds.
Thank you, Leonard Perlmutter, author of Your Conscience. For anything Tributaries related, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasts are in the usual places. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.